Spirit Blade Underground, episode 358. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 358.
Hello and welcome to the monitor room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, some thoughts on the premiere of AD The Bible Continues. I know that I said last week that my plan was to review Ex Machina, but as I usually do, I went to IMDb to check out a little bit more information about the rating and why it was rated R. It looks like there's some nudity in there, and frequently enough that I just wanted to stay away from it and figured I probably wouldn't be able to recommend it anyway based on the descriptions at the content, whatever you call that, content advisory at imdb.com, which is a great resource, by the way. It's definitely helped me avoid some stuff that wouldn't be good for me. So, I want to say thank you to Matt McKinney. And I think I say it again in the recording that you'll hear of my my thoughts. But he pointed me to the premiere of the TV series AD The Bible Continues. And there was a lot of interesting stuff to talk about after watching that pilot. So that's what I'm going to share my thoughts on today. And then I'm also going to, in our In Search of Truth segment, talk about what the superior sacrifice of Jesus means for geeks, as we see the author of Hebrews getting into some of that kind of stuff. All right, let's get to it. Well, it's Groundhog Day again. Not really, but this is my second time recording this because I had some audio problems the first time. Oh my gosh! But I want to talk about AD, The Bible Continues. I want to say thank you to Matt McKinney for pointing me to this series, which I thought was going to be just some Talking Heads one-hour special or something. But this is going to be like a TV series, I guess. I'm not sure how long it's going to last, but some really interesting stuff to talk about here. Now, first, I should say that, you know, normally I don't review this kind of stuff. I justified reviewing this because potentially when you're dealing with the supernatural, it does have some geek appeal. You know, that's why I reviewed, say, Left Behind, but I'm not reviewing other, you know, Christian movies or something like that. You know, I don't review just movies in general. I like to review movies that specifically are targeted at geeks or that have some level of geek appeal. And I think that the story of the resurrection and the events of the New Testament, certainly with their supernatural elements, can have some cool geek appeal. So, although I should say that probably beyond today, I'm probably not going to be discussing this series a lot more just because the geek appeal, I think, is a bit thin. But I do want to talk about this pilot here. Now, first, this isn't going to be like a normal review, but I do want to touch on just, you know, what I do think about some of the aspects that I would normally talk about in review, like the story. The story starts in the middle of Jesus' trial and carries through to the kickoff of his resurrection, and basically deals with what his followers are experiencing, thinking about, fearing, hoping during that time period. The performances are really solid. They got, for TV anyway, they got really solid actors in all of the main roles. I don't have any complaints there. I can always complain, but I think for a TV show, I don't have legitimate reason to complain. The costumes and sets all look nice, again, for a TV show. When TV shows try to cover these types of time periods, things always look a little bit too clean and not lived in enough for me. I would love it if they had time to really texture the sets and the costumes so it really feels a little bit more real and lived in. But for a TV show, I think they do a really great job. The music is interesting. They do a mix of orchestral stuff and a little bit of like rock flavors here and there. I would have liked something a little bit more Middle Eastern to kind of convey the ethnic and historical sense of the story, although I don't think the ethnicity is really a high value for them in this show. I'll get to that a little bit later. And the visual effects and the makeup and stuff like that, I thought it all looked really nice, served its purpose well for a TV show. There's a cool part where an angel shows up and the effects that are accompanying that, they look really cool. So it presents itself really well in that scene. Anyway, so let's get on to like the content, the things that people are probably mostly going to be talking about when it comes to this pilot and probably the rest of this series, and that is its fidelity to the source material. Now, I think that you can really analyze and get into the historical trivia aspects, and I think that's a worthwhile exercise, but it's not really something that interests me. When it comes to movies like this, or shows like this, or movies like the Noah movie, or Exodus Gods and Kings, I'm more interested about a few key message factors than I am the historical tidbits of who, what, when, and where. I care more about how God is represented and how the human condition is represented. And so that's mainly what I'm going to be focusing kind of my thoughts on as I compare this presentation of the story to the source material. So first I'll talk about what I would call maybe the Christian influence. I have no idea, but just the impression I got, and I'm completely ignorant here, the impression I got is that this is largely made by people who wanted to create something that was targeted at the Christian demographic, but maybe themselves aren't super invested in this or don't take it as their own faith and something that they really believe in. But that maybe there are also some Christians, one or two, involved in the writing process. Because there's be these little blips on the radar. I think, oh man, that's interesting. That's something that strikes me like it's something that like only a Christian would really care to include and make a point of putting in there. So that's what I would call, I guess, the Christian influence that, I see. Who knows what the real cause is. But the first thing I noticed is, what is truth? And that's a phrase that starts out the pilot and remains kind of a bit of an idea that's returned to over the course of the pilot. Of course, Pontius Pilate says that to Jesus when Jesus said that he came to represent the truth and that all that are on the side of truth listen to him. And Pilate says, what is truth? And I love the way that the actor handled that. I've seen a few different actors handle that phrase, and I love the way that he handled it, with just this kind of like perplexed, mystified, what am I supposed to do in this situation, and what does that really mean, you know? I think that's such a relevant question today in modern pop spiritual America, where we really don't value truth as a whole. You know, in broad strokes, Americans are not interested in truth. We all just want to believe what we want to believe and let each other believe what they want to believe, and kind of somehow everybody's right, you know. But really, if we're going to value truth, then we really can't conclude that everyone's right. And there has to be, a single truth. And, of course, there can be, multiple. No, I'm not going to go into that. But truth does not contradict itself. Truth is absolute by its very nature as a representation of that which is real, what is really real, you know. So so anyway, I thought it was interesting, this idea of truth being come back to several times. And then the second thing I noticed was that the curtain or the veil in the temple was torn. And this was very briefly shown. I'm not sure if they actually were showing what was supposed to be the inner curtain, but that's the one that's being referred to in the New Testament accounts that talk about this. At the climax of Jesus' crucifixion, the temple veil is torn in two, and this was the veil that separated the priests and common people, of course, from the most holy place in the temple, which represented God's dwelling among his people, his presence among his people. And only one guy, the high priest, could go in there one time a year. And even then, he had to bring a sacrifice with him. And so it was just kind of a constant reminder of this separation that we have from God because of our sin. And a separation that's necessary if we're going to say that God is a holy, just, and perfect God. A holy, just, and perfect God wouldn't just kind of shrug his shoulders at our selfishness and our evil. And just say, well, what are you going to do? I guess I'll just let them keep hurting each other and themselves. And, we can't do that and still have a picture of a holy, perfect God intact. So there's this separation. That's what the whole sacrificial system of the old covenant was pointing to. And but it all became obsolete because of Jesus' sacrifice, which was of infinite worth because he himself is God and offered up his life as a sacrifice to pay for all of the sins of the world, so that all who believe in him can have their his record of righteousness placed over their own and have access to God and not have this barrier of sin, you know, hanging over them and disrupting any potential relationship that they might have with God. So that was huge. I mean, I'm wondering if maybe like the producers, or they just kind of included that, like, oh, that's cool and weird, you know, that's kind of neat and supernatural, let's throw that in there. And people just wonder and say, ooh, that's mysterious, because they're postmodern and they like mysterious things that don't make sense, you know. But so maybe that's why it got in there. But it has really huge significance in terms of what Jesus' purpose was in coming to the world and dying, you know. Number three, I noticed that the swoon theory is debunked. This is an old theory that really isn't taken seriously among scholars anymore, but as far as I know, but is still kind of like this idea floating out there that people might subscribe to. It's the idea that Jesus just kind of got hurt really bad, but didn't really quite die. He just maybe stopped breathing for a while, or just really, really was almost dead. And then he kind of woke up and started feeling better and somehow pushed away the stone and, you know, it's a weird theory. It doesn't make any sense completely, which is why it's really not, you know, considered serious among scholars anymore. But they took pains in a scene with Pontius Pilate talking to the Roman officer Cornelius, who was in charge of making sure that Jesus was dead. They took pains to go through the gory details and Cornelius was like, yeah, I mean, you're mad or you're a fool at this point if you would tell me that Jesus did not die. He's dead. So that was interesting. The fourth thing I noticed was that the Isaiah prophecy from chapter 53 of the book of Isaiah was mentioned in here, at least a part of it, verse 9, which says, "And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death." And this whole chapter is about the Messiah. And the idea that, you know, here is that he died among the wicked, and then in his death after that was with the wealthy, was with a rich man, you know, because he ended up in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, which Joseph was a wealthy man, and Jesus died. He entered the grave with a wicked man on each side of him, a robber and a thief and a murderer. And the fifth thing I noticed is that the Pharisees/Caiaphas understood Jesus' claim to resurrection. They understood that he was claiming that he was going to rise from death. And they even thought that his disciples would catch on to that. So it was fairly, they understood clearly that Jesus was predicting his own resurrection. Matthew 27:62-64 in the ESV says, "The next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, 'Sir, we remember how that impostor said, while he was still alive, after 3 days I will rise. Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first." So I think that was a worthwhile detail to include, and a bit of an irony that the priests, that Caiaphas understood that Jesus was claiming that he was going to rise from the dead, but the disciples didn't. And I'll come back to that in a second as we now get into my thoughts on what I think were maybe the Hollywood, for lack of a better phrase, Hollywood influence on the movie. I really don't know what motivated some of these things that I'm going to talk about now. I don't think there's anything malicious involved. I think it was just kind of this strange ignorance or I don't know what it was. It's just kind of weird. But it does, these changes, I think, do potentially change the message of the Bible as they represent it in this story. The first thing is, we have a handsome and charismatic Jesus, and they've been doing this for years in movies about Jesus, you know, that, you know, you're casting an actor, and actors that have the experience to take on a role like this usually got, you know, their first gigs because they're handsome, you know? So, or at least that plays a major role, is what I mean to say. So anyway, you know, it's kind of hard to avoid, you know, a handsome Jesus. I kind of get that. And I think they probably want to pay respects and not be offensive, you know, not offend Christians. But I mean, really, if we look at Isaiah 53, because the New Testament doesn't really give physical descriptions of Jesus, but Isaiah 53 verse 2, which they validate as a prophecy about the Messiah in this series, it says, "He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and had no beauty that we should desire him." So anyway, I think that's a worthwhile point to make, that Jesus came in this humble form, that he didn't come as this attractive, necessarily charismatic person. In fact, the New Testament doesn't really describe him as charismatic. It just describes people being blown away by his teaching, by the content, by the truth that he was giving people. Second thing I noticed, man, the offbeat ethnic casting in this series. Man, there's a whole lot of white people in this show, and two random, what seemed to me like, we got to check the box and put some black people in this thing too. You know, there's mysteriously few Middle Eastern people and few to none in the key roles. Really weird to me. I saw there was some people that definitely had a Middle Eastern look to them in these kind of like side peripheral roles. And I said to my wife, I was like, man, they should be playing Peter and John. What is going on with the casting here? You know, and I had just come off of watching The Passion a few days ago for the first time in years, and so it left a strong impression on me. And I know that, you know, nobody except for a few people would be interested in watching a show like this in subtitles. I would at least have liked some kind of Middle Eastern accents. I would have loved to have Middle Eastern actors, you know, playing all these parts. Man, I can get over it. I can get over the white people and the other strange casting. I guess I can get over them speaking in English. That just took a little adjustment. I can get over the British accents, I think. I think I can get over that. But man, that's weird to me. Anyway, whatever. Let's see what else. Okay, the number three thing that I noticed in this category is when John... I think it was Peter, actually, in this story. He said, when he was in a moment where I think he was kind of supposed to be summing up what Jesus' teaching was about, at least what he thought Jesus' teaching was about. He said, he taught us to treat others the way that we want to be treated, you know? And that was really interesting to me, because that is what I think that's the popular idea of what Jesus' teaching was kind of all about. If you want to boil it down, this is basically what he taught, is let's treat each other the way that we want to be treated. And certainly that was a message of Jesus, but it wasn't revolutionary in the sense that, compared to the other things that he taught. Now, maybe that kind of thinking had fallen out of favor a bit, but those ideas are in the Tanakh. They're in the Old Testament, you know, to love your neighbor as yourself. That is in the Old Testament. And so that wasn't like this radical new idea, oh my gosh, you know, that Jesus would really be like known for. It's like, have you heard of this guy who wants us to love each other like we love our, like we want to be loved, you know? So I think that's kind of weird, as that being a summary. But I mean, okay, I can accept, though, that Peter didn't get at that time, as none of the disciples did, what Jesus really came to do, what his mission was about, and really what the foundation and the core of his teaching was really about. They didn't get it. But what they were confused about did not lead them to this idea. What it led them to, that we see in Scripture, is really getting focused on the kingdom aspect of what Jesus was preaching in the wrong way, because Jesus was talking about ushering in this new kingdom, this whole new role that he was going to be leading, that really all of humanity was going to be invited to be a part of. It's just a whole new way of humanity existing, you know, the kingdom of God. That's what he was ushering in. And they really viewed it as a political kingdom. They viewed it as this thing that Jesus was going to lead, kind of this revolution, and the Jewish people were going to be freed from the Roman Empire. They were going to have their own nation again that was free from any rule over them by another country. And, you know, they would argue among themselves about who would get to be his right-hand man and where people would sit at the table and to have their, you know, the higher status and stuff. That's all that they were focused on, was this kind of like this political movement, or this, you know, that they thought Jesus was about to, you know, kick off, you know? And so that, if anything, is what I think Peter at this point would have summarized, as being Jesus' teaching, you know, what he was all about. This just smells more like what the common, you know, misinformed or willfully ignorant person thinks of as being what Jesus was all about. He certainly was about that. But I think as you read through the Gospels, and, you know, you can read them again and tell me what you think. But I think as I read the Gospels, I do not see that as like this main message that he had that would be like the one thing that people remembered if they forgot everything else, you know. So anyway, that was a kind of a strange choice. Let's see here. Oh, another thing I noticed, number four on this list, would be Mary's understanding of the resurrection. So we've got Mary, the mother of Jesus, which of course can be identified by her blue clothing. We all know that she wore blue because we've seen that on greeting cards for years. The dialogue, you know, tips us off several times that this is the mother of Jesus. But she's talking about, like, don't you guys realize he's going to rise from death on the third day? And I don't think that we see that in the Bible. We see a couple of Marys spending time with the disciples during this time period. We see Mary, the mother of Jesus, certainly at Golgotha while Jesus is being crucified. We see this Mary that's referred to as Mary, the mother of James. And some scholars have concluded that James is the half-brother of Jesus, and this Mary is the mother of James, is also the mother of Jesus. But not all scholars agree on that. So, but let's assume for a moment that Mary is the mother of James. Well, in the biblical account, she brought spices to the tomb also. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, maybe we'll see it in the next episode. I don't know. Mark 16:1 says, when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, and Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. They're talking about the body of Jesus. And this was a practice that was done to, it was kind of like an embalming type thing where they would do this to keep the body from just from stinking as it decayed, you know? And so this was not a practice that was done to anticipate resurrection. It was a practice that was done to deal with the reality of death. And so if Mary, the mother of James, is Mary, the mother of Jesus, then she shouldn't in this story be anticipating resurrection. And if Mary, the mother of James, is not Mary, the mother of Jesus, then we really shouldn't be seeing Mary, the mother of Jesus a whole lot right now in this story or going forward from here. You know, she really kind of vanishes soon after the crucifixion and certainly the resurrection. I'm not sure if she's mentioned in Acts. I don't recall offhand, but I mean, she's really fades to the background big time. So what I'm wondering is if we're going to see, out of a desire to appeal to the large Catholic demographic, I'm wondering if we'll see a more prominent Mary than we should if we're trying to tell the story of the Bible, and also an elevated Mary, who's kind of like the first one to understand Jesus and know what we're supposed to do and kind of the person they all look to. And, you know, I wonder if she'll kind of be like this figure that they turn to for wisdom, you know. It'll be interesting. And I also suspect that if they go that route to kind of appeal to the Catholic demographic, that we might see a more respectable Peter than he is as he's in the Bible. Because even after the resurrection of Jesus, certainly during this time, Peter was just screwing things up, and we see that. He, you know, we see his cowardice here, but we see him screwing things up after this too, you know. So it'll just be interesting to see how they handle Peter. The fifth thing I noticed is that not just Mary, but all the disciples in the show seemed to consider and even hope for Jesus' resurrection. Now, the Pharisees knew what Jesus meant. They knew he was claiming, they took him at face value when he said, you know, that the Son of Man must rise, the stuff about this temple. I'm trying to remember if they heard him say rise. I know they heard him say about the temple, that you destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. However, in the Bible, the disciples are depicted as not expecting resurrection, despite Jesus telling them in advance. They just kind of thick. They weren't getting it. Peter and John don't even seem to be looking for resurrection, certainly not hoping for one. It doesn't seem to be even like a possibility for them. When they examine the tomb in John chapter 20, verses 8 and 9, it's described this way. Then the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went in, and he saw and believed, for as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. So they didn't get it yet. It just wasn't really on their radar. Number six. Let's see here. Hang on a second. Sorry about that. During this time, the resurrection was not even like a single person concept. It was exclusively thought of as a future event for all people. In talking to the sister of Lazarus, just before raising him from the dead, Jesus says in John 11, verses 23 and 24, he says, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." So, you know, he was trying to say, your brother, I'm about to raise your brother from the dead, you know? And she said, and she didn't get it. She didn't even like, it wasn't even on her radar. She was like, yeah, he's going to rise from the dead with the resurrection at the last. It was this future event that would happen to all people, you know? And it is that. There is a resurrection event coming. But it wasn't even on the radar that like a single person could be raised from the dead. Now you could argue, as I think this episode kind of does, that since they saw Lazarus get raised from the dead, that maybe they would be willing to believe this idea that Jesus would, you know, raise himself from the dead. But again, I think if we look at the text in John 20 verses 8 and 9, I don't think that was on their radar. It says they saw and then they believed, for as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. So, if you want more information about just kind of like the historical background and the evidences for the resurrection, I would recommend Dr. William Lane Craig. He's written extensively on the topic. So check out, you know, some of his books on that. William Lane Craig. He's also got a podcast called The Defenders podcast series, which you should be able to find if you use his name and search Defenders. And that's a good resource for what he's got to share as well. And then lastly, John comforts Peter at one point. Peter's feeling really guilty because he was not there. He was too cowardly to be there on Golgotha when Jesus was experiencing his last moments of suffering. And so he's understandably feeling guilty about that. And John says he understood our weakness. He loved us for it. Now, in this context, weakness is referring to sin. Peter was feeling guilty because he was not a good enough friend and a brave enough friend to spend those last moments with his friend Jesus as he was dying. So he was, you know, he was seeing, I think we can replace that word weakness with sin in this context. That's what they were talking about. It was something he felt he needed to feel bad about. It wasn't just like my muscles weren't strong enough. It was a flaw in his character. It was sin. So, but John says to him, he understood our weakness or sin, we would say. He loved us for it. Now that's interesting. Does God love us for our sin? Does he love us because of our sin? Does he love us? Boy, you know, I just love how selfish they are and how they just think about themselves all the time. And I love how they just kind of disregard each other and don't look out for the good of each other. You know, I just love that about them. You know, no, what kind of a crazy, evil, messed up God would that be? No. What we see in the Bible is that he loves us despite our sin. He has this love for us that just fights beyond his disgust over our sin and continues to faithfully love us despite our sin. That's a concept of God that retains his absolute perfection and also is even more intense love for us than the love that John was potentially describing there. And you know, that kind of leads me to one of the things that I really want to see in this show, and that is the gospel. And what I mean by that is the gospel, I mean, it's a broad term. It just means good news. But as it's used, as you look at the context of how it's used in the New Testament, it refers to the fact that Jesus as God himself was qualified to, it's the good news that Jesus as God himself was qualified to pay for our sins completely with his self-sacrifice. And by doing so, reconcile us to God through belief in him, and then proving his identity by a physical, real resurrection. And that word reconcile is like a key word for me that I'm still waiting to see. Because right now, the impression that I get is that Jesus came, from this show, I get the impression that Jesus came, and the main thing that he taught was, let's love each other the way we want to be loved. He was this inspiring example, and he even kind of loved our sin, too. There wasn't anything that wrong with us that really needed fixing. And then, man, wasn't it sad that he died? But he's going to rise from the dead to prove how you know, he should be listened to, and that his message about loving each other should really be listened to, because he is the Messiah, and they don't really define that, but he is this kind of supernatural figure that we ought to be listening to. That was interesting, too, that they said Messiah a lot. They didn't say Son of God, certainly didn't say God, but really, he was crucified because of his blasphemy, because he put himself on a status equal to God. When he was saying that he was the Son of God, in that culture, being the son of someone made you, you know, their peer, their equal. You were going to be the inheritor of all that they had. And so by saying he was the Son of God, even though it's not this literal biological, you know, kind of son, what he was saying was, I am this unique figure and I have a status equal to God. And that's why he was crucified. So anyway, I want to see this idea of reconciliation. I want to see this recognition that there's something wrong with us, that we are, and as a result of our sin, we are separated from God, and we need rescuing from that condition. And I haven't seen that yet. It looks like he's going to rise from the dead, and like, wow, he really was this special person. We should listen to him. And because we saw this spectacular thing, we're going to dedicate our lives to loving each other. Now we'll really be serious, because we saw these crazy special effects and we saw this guy rise from the dead and then fly up into the sky. So man, let's really be about love, because we just saw that. That was crazy. I mean, I have trouble buying into that motivation. The motivation that's easier to understand from what radically changed these guys is that they were doubting him. And they were not expecting resurrection. And what changed them was seeing him rise from the dead and then understanding what he had done for them. Because that's what the rest of the Bible is about. It's all about the gospel. It's about this reconciliation between humanity and God. And it's about this amazing hope that we have for the future as a result of that. You know, we have the hope of spending eternity with a God who doesn't just kind of go, all right, well, you guys play together, try not to fight, you know. But he fixes and redeems us and rescues us from that condition. And it's this amazing hope. And that I can see them, you know, having this radical transformation and seeing this, this resurrection of Jesus, and that being something worth dying for, getting that message out there. But just a message of, let's just really try to make the world a better place by being loving to each other. That's a motivation that's harder for me to buy. Let's see here. Yeah, I mean, is it harmful what they're doing, you know, in changing the message? I don't know. But I can see a scenario where someone who's watching this show and kind of believes that we don't really need fixing and Jesus' main message was love each other, that this could be just kind of an affirmation of that. And they could just kind of shrug at the supernatural stuff and say, okay, well, the producers decided to treat that as being real and that having really happened and stuff like that, you know. But the show, if it perpetuates this idea that we really don't need to be reconciled with God, he just loves us and is content for us to go on sinning and being selfish and hurting ourselves and each other, you know, I think that could potentially be harmful if this show in someone's mind, it kind of affirms that or enables further them hanging on to that kind of mindset. But I mean, you know, that's going to depend on the individual and, you know, how they're influenced by entertainment content and whatever. So I mean, I'm not scared of this show and I'm not angry about this show or anything like that. You know, I think I want to applaud NBC because this, you know, it got me into my Bible for a little extra time than I normally would be and gave me a reason to talk about this stuff. Hopefully it's giving you a reason to talk about this stuff too. It has good production values and performances. I mean, I think we ought to give this show our click and let NBC know, yes, I want more content like this, you know? So I think that the best thing that this show has done so far for me and hopefully will continue to do for lots of people in the future is get us to talk about the New Testament and get us to open up our Bibles. That's awesome. That's awesome. And, you know, it's not a bad production value. As far as production values, it's not a bad show to, you know, to sit through. But what I want to see in the future of this show is the gospel being at the core of everything else, because that's what the rest of the New Testament is about. The gospel is at its core. It motivates everything. The gospel is rescue. It's not just an inspiring example. And if the series wants to call itself a continuation of the Bible, which it does, AD, the Bible continues, then I think it should reflect that and let its main characters be motivated by the gospel rather than dance around it or only vaguely touch on it now and then. All right, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I'm sure there's lots of different thoughts spinning around, and so I'd love to get yours. You can put those in the comments below, and yeah, what else? That's it. All right, I'm not editing this. I'm tired. This second time I've done this. And what is this video, like 30 minutes long? I've been doing this for 60 minutes. It takes a lot of energy to do this. I want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
In this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language that we take for granted, digging into history and languages when I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in Scripture, just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth, and I hope you'll do that with me. This time, we're looking at the book of Hebrews chapter 10, verses 19 through 23. I'll read it in the ESV. It says, "Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened up for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful." All right, well, up until this point in the book of Hebrews, the author's been explaining and then emphasizing the absolute sufficiency of Jesus' sacrifice to pay the penalty for our sins once and for all, contrasting his work on our behalf with the Old Covenant's ultimately ineffective sacrificial system. He sums it up in verses 19 through 21, from which I think we can conclude a few things. Number one, we have every reason to enter the holy places, it says, with confidence, so not with dread or hesitation. And you might remember that this holy places refers to the true holy places where God dwells in his full glory. So we can enter into the presence of God not with dread or hesitation, but with absolute confidence. And if you want to refresh your memory on that, on what the holy places refers to, that's in Hebrews 8, verses 1 and 2. We're not good enough to have a relationship with an uncompromisingly holy God. I think that sometimes can be the mentality, among non-believers, that, at the end of the day, I'm doing good enough, to go to heaven or whatever their idea is there. But we're not good enough to have a relationship with an uncompromisingly holy God. He would be less than perfect if he just shrugged and threw up his hands at our sin, as I kind of mentioned in my thoughts on AD. But God has made it possible for us to be with him without shame or fear, fear of condemnation. All right, so number two that I think we can pick up from these verses, this is made possible by the infinite worth of the payment Jesus offered. That's how it's possible for us to be in the presence of God without shame or fear of condemnation. His own body and lifeblood, which endured the punishment we were due, makes that possible. This payment made the inner temple curtain obsolete. And this curtain was used under the Old Covenant to separate everyone from the revealed presence of God. As I said, again, on my 80 thoughts, interesting, just the timing that I noticed in watching AD and kind of the things they did here and the timing of us arriving here in Hebrews. So maybe there's something here that Yahweh particularly wants to draw our attention to. I'll let you guys sort through that. But anyway, regarding that curtain, it separated everyone from the revealed presence of God. Only the high priest could go beyond that curtain, and even then just once a year, to offer a sacrifice. And at the climax of Jesus' suffering on the cross, this curtain was torn in half, and we see that in Luke 23, verses 44 through 46. The new curtain that, quote-unquote, that was brutally opened up, in a sense, to give us access to God, is the flesh of Jesus. Through his sacrifice, our guilt no longer prevents us from being in relationship with God. All right. Number three that I think I can see in these verses here is Jesus is the ultimate bridge between us and God. The old covenant function of priests was to mediate the relationship between people and Yahweh. Jesus is the ideal and ultimate priest over all household affairs of God. You might remember that kind of phrase that I arrived at from our look at Hebrews chapter 3, verse 6. And I think it's the same idea that's being expressed here when it's talking about the house of God. It's the household affairs of God, what his agenda is, what his plan is for the universe. He is both the ultimate priest over all the household affairs of God. He's both over us and beside us. He takes away sterilized formality and brings intimate familiarity to our relationship with God. These are realities that can change and revitalize the way we think about and approach every area of life. In light of these truths, the author begins describing how we can and should approach everyday life. Regarding verse 22, I think we see here that we should constantly be moving deeper into relationship with God, sincerely involving our entire inner being. If the author hasn't been clear enough, superficial ritual does not interest God or bring us closer to Him. A true worship relationship with God is one that learns and reflects on truth and responds and invests emotionally. For more on that idea, look at John chapter 4, verses 23 and 24. The religious leaders of Jesus' day were in some ways like modern geeks, I think. They were really into the Tanakh, the Old Testament. They analyzed it, they debated over it, they obsessed about complex intellectual concepts, and these are all actually good things. But they kept their faith a matter of the mind. And they just enjoyed the intellectual exercise, I think, in many ways, debating these things and examining these things. But they never really let that truth penetrate their hearts. They kept themselves at this sort of cold intellectual distance from God when their study should have led them deeper into an authentic emotional investment in God. Jesus said, and it's just springing to mind now, so I don't recall the reference, but Jesus said to the Pharisees that you search the scriptures because you believe in them you have life, but the scriptures point to me. So they were engaged in this intellectual exercise with the scripture, and really thought, you know, that was the thing, and it was, but it should have pointed them to a devotion toward a devotion to Jesus. The second half of verse 22 likely refers to the spiritual cleansing that we receive from Jesus and the physical washing, the baptism that symbolizes that. We should trust and then experience inwardly that we have been made clean. The evil that once defined us has been washed away, despite the fact that a frustrating superficial remnant remains, which I think we see in Romans 7, 18, verses 18 and 25. Despite that, we're not defined by it. The evil that once was part of our definition has been washed away. Despite the broken way that the world looks at things, we are not defined by our appearance, our character flaws, or our weaknesses. And believers in Jesus have those elements wiped from their definition. And then in verse 23, we should hold on securely to a habit of openly expressing, or as it says, confessing here, the hope that we have because of what Jesus has done for us. We should remind ourselves, we should remind each other that we're being perfected by God and will be made perfect one day. It's so easy to just get stuck in thinking about the here and now and the situation that we're in now, the people that we are now, the sins that we struggle with now. We should be reminding ourselves of the very real hope. It's not just this fuzzy, nice idea. This is a reality. This is something that we can look forward to and know that it's coming. We're constantly being invited through our mundane everyday lives to be used by God for his epic and cosmic household affairs. We have no reason to be ashamed in the presence of a holy and perfect God anymore. The pain, frustration, and suffering in this life will be over before we know it, and we can look forward to a thrilling and fulfilling eternal future with Yahweh God, who amazingly calls us his children, his kids, and his friends. So these are things we should be reminding each other on the forums, or, you know, away from the keyboard in our day-to-day relationships, when our friends and family are experiencing frustration and suffering. And I know that can be hard to do. You know, it's hard to not just give people this kind of, canned, easy answer. But we ought to be looking for ways that aren't canned and easy to encourage people and remind people of this truth and remind ourselves of this truth. I need to remember this truth so much. I can so get stuck in the here and now. Geeks, I notice, often really enjoy fixating on and obsessing over things. That's just kind of part of who we are. We find stuff that we dig on and we obsess on it. Or we obsess on things sometimes that aren't really helpful or might even be harmful, you know, like which is better, DC or Marvel? You know, I guess that can be a fun conversation. I've certainly engaged in it, you know, but it's, I don't know that it's particularly helpful. And we can even, you know, obsess over harmful things, you know, like reliving or dreading difficult social relational situations. Despite the pointless topics or negative thoughts we so easily prefer to dwell on, there is so much real, concrete hope worth remembering and obsessing over. And the promises our hope is attached to are made by the same God who has proven repeatedly throughout history that when he says something, it's gonna happen. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind that you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we can, but we have to hear from you to do that. So you can send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net, either with text or just record a little message and send it that way. Most smartphones can do that kind of thing. Let's see here. I'm going to be off grid. I actually started being off-grid on Thursday of this week, off-grid until April 28th. I was going to wait until Monday to do this, but I had to prep 3 podcasts this week instead of just one because I wanted to keep the content updated even while I was off-grid. So there won't be an interruption in either the YouTube content or the podcast content. In fact, there's going to be more than one video per week, I think this week and next on the YouTube channel. So yeah, but I will not be reachable by email. I won't be answering my email, so that won't be a good way to reach me. But I'm going to be hard at work on Spirit Blade: A World of Shadows. I've got my eyes fixed on this October release date, and I'd really love to still see that happen. So that's a big part of why I'm taking 2 weeks to go off grid. It's just to work constantly, really hard for 2 weeks on that. I am in need of, I guess I don't need this, but this would be really helpful. I'm interested in getting someone to help me with a Summer of Free blog that wouldn't be updated except for, you know, a few months every year. But basically just a copy editor at this point. I don't need someone that's going to commit long-term to something that, you know, with Summer of Free. But right now, you know, we've got all this history of posts and stuff that that are on the Spirit Blade blog, and that, you know, I'll sometimes post also on Christian Geek Central. And I'd love for the Summer of Free to have its own home that people can, you know, more easily kind of sift through and find free geek entertainment that they can take advantage of. And that, you know, also might potentially be just an outreach for other people that, you know, wouldn't find Christian Geek Central or Spirit Blade or the Spirit Blade Underground any other way, but they might find this blog because it's about free geek stuff, you know. So I'm interested in transferring the existing Summer of Free posts from years past over to a new blog site and then continuing updates there. So they can all be in one easy to find and browse place. But I just don't, it's not complicated stuff. I would just be needing to give someone access to the blogs, the Spirit Blade Underground blog, and you know, the back end, and then this new blog, give them author permissions, so that it's basically just going to be copying and pasting. So it's just a little bit tedious. It's not, but it's not complex stuff at all, I don't think. So if you'd be willing to help me with that, that's something I would love to have set up and ready to go for when we launch the Summer of Free this summer, which I will probably kick off at the end of May. So in the meantime, I'd love to have somebody help me get that content transferred hands forward and kind of give the Summer of Free a nice new home. So if you'd be interested in helping me with that, please email me at paeter@spiritblade.net. I want to highly recommend that you guys go to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. I did a trial and error video, which is basically me doing picture-in-picture gameplay of a game, trying it out, and usually playing it terribly. And this time around, I did Bloodborne. But because I suck at action games of all kinds, I got two friends of mine from the College 20s ministry that me and Holly are involved in our church. I got two of those guys to come over and actually play the game with me and take turns playing it, so that at least there would be some other perspective other than mine, because you know what mine's going to be. It's going to be, this game is terrible. Why in the world would anybody make this game or want to play it? And you'll see why I have that opinion as you watch me play. But that, you know, sometimes I'll double the content and lift the audio from a YouTube video and put it on the podcast, you know. But that just didn't make sense. It just wouldn't make good audio content. It really only works, and I think works pretty well in this case, with the video. So if you want to see me just hanging out with some guys and sucking at video games, and also kind of talking about, you know, how do we as Christians engage with content like that in Bloodborne, which is like, you know, really dark and bloody and horror, you know, based. So we get into, you know, all kinds of different stuff in that video. And then next week I'm also going to post a long version of that. The cut-up version runs about 25 minutes, but I recorded a total of like over 90 minutes, I think, and I'm going to post the longer version of that next week. But the cream of the crop, I think, or at least the stuff that specifically pertains to Bloodborne, is in this shorter video. The longer one includes all the stuff where we're just riffing and talking about all kinds of aspects of geek culture that the game was kind of bringing to mind as we played it. So anyway, I hope you'll check out that video, youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. And I also hope that you'll like, share, subscribe. That will help kind of give us some exposure to other folks that maybe aren't engaging with the podcast but are engaging via YouTube. So that would really help us out if you do that. And I want your voice and your interests to be a part of this podcast and the YouTube channel and all of Christian Geek Central. So whether you have an idea for a segment already or you just want to be a part of the fun, we want to find a way to plug you in and let your voice be heard. It's also a great way to promote what you're doing if you'd like. For more info, please email me at paeter@spiritblade.net. All right, that's it, guys. Stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 to start from the beginning. Next week, if God wants it to happen, I am going to share the first part of a viewer-requested bookshelf tour of all the geeky stuff going on in the bookshelf that you often see if you're watching the YouTube videos you see in the background. I'm going to kind of just take you through in a multi-part feature all the things on that bookshelf and kind of give commentary on why I like them or my thoughts on those things as I go through. So part one of that will be on the podcast and the YouTube channel next week. And next week on the podcast, I'm also going to talk about geeks and the local church, which is, I think, a topic that just begs to be talked about with the next couple of verses that we're going to get to in the book of Hebrews. All right. Well, till then, check out spiritblade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff that's made just for you. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Friends and with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.net. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
All right, so we just finished up episode 304, season 3 of Farscape, Self-Inflicted Wounds, part 2. So Ding Dong Xan is dead. You know, I've made no secret of the fact that I really don't care for Xan as a character. She very often is one that gets on my nerves. You know, it's interesting that even at the end here, one thing I appreciate about Xan and the way they constructed her character is that she is a little hypocritical at times, sometimes very hypocritical, you know. And, you know, she had some moments where she was flawed in this episode. I mean, there's one where she, like, kind of flips out on Aaron and her eyes go red and stuff. And you could chalk that up and not count that against her and say it's just, you know, she's kind of out of her mind because of what's happening to her body and stuff, you know. But there was also this moment where she said to John, you know, once again, your excuses have failed us, or something to that extent. You know, she's just not, you know, she's just being very judgmental of him in that moment, and kind of, you know, breaking under pressure a bit. And so I appreciate those moments where the writers will do that. Not that that's, you know, unusual, to take a, you know, religious character and make them hypocritical. But what is unusual is that she, that her religion is not this kind of monotheistic thing. I mean, there is kind of, you know, she's talking about the goddess and stuff, but it's much more about this kind of, I don't even know how to describe it, this really just kind of vague spirituality that doesn't have anything really concrete about it, you know, which is much more like relativism or some kind of polytheism or, you know, some kind of, you know, I don't know what. But so that's what's unusual, is to take a character like that subscribes to that kind of theology slash philosophy and make them hypocritical. You know, that's a little bit unusual. And, you know, it's funny, as much as I don't like the character, I found in my viewings of this episode at the end to still be sobered by her death, and that's because the other characters care about her. The crew, I guess you'd call it, they care about her, and they are mourning her death, you know? It's kind of like that episode when Aaron, you know, cried as that little cute alien was dying in her arms. You know, I didn't think the cute alien was very impressive at all, but Aaron's, I was going to say her performance, or Claudia Black's performance, and just emotionally reacting to it made me a little bit sobered by that moment, you know, and so the same thing was true here. So my hat's off to the cast, you know, for just participating in that send-off for this character. What do I want to talk? I'll talk about the behind-the-scenes stuff on that, you know, whole thing in just a second here, but there's something else I wanted to mention. Oh, yeah, it's this whole idea where, this is really interesting, that Zan says that before, when she was facing death, she was concerned because her essence or her spirit or whatever the crap, you know, wouldn't be up ready for passing on, you know, but she said, now I know that I'm worthy. That's really interesting, because usually, you know, the reaction of popular culture for anyone to describe themselves as worthy, you know, kind of rubs us the wrong way, gives us this, you know, kind of like the vibe of entitlement coming from that person, or just kind of like pride, you know. And I, you know, I even, you know, was finding myself asking the question, okay, well, worthy of what? Worthy of what? Worthy of like some kind of great afterlife? Because it brings into question all the, you know, the whole morality system of the goddess, you know, which I think I've kind of touched on before. But like, well, really, I mean, you were just a jerk to John a little while ago. Did you apologize to John for that? No, you didn't make that right. So if your system is based on kind of like making things right with the people you've wronged, you've definitely dropped the ball on that one. I mean, you've killed people in the past, murdered people, you know, in your life before Moya, you know, you murdered people and I'm sure destroyed the lives of the survivors of the people that you killed as a result of that. You haven't made any of those things right. So then that makes me ask the question, okay, well, if there's some kind of cosmic economy of morality, you know, that, okay, you have to make up maybe for the bad things that you do, by doing good things, maybe that's what happened. Maybe this final self-sacrifice made up for, you know, her being a judgmental kind of jerk to a Crichton. You know, as soon as you stop and start like kind of picking these things apart, it all kind of starts to unravel. You know, it's all really sounds nice on the surface, but, you know, that whole like balance thing, you know, when I think about that kind of theology, the theology of balance, you know, like the force, you know, the light and the dark, and they balance each other out and stuff like that. You know, it's interesting, we'll see characters that, like, live horrible lives. I'm not saying that Zan, you know, at least as we've seen her on Moya, has lived this horrible life. But, you know, you take, like, a Darth Vader-type character, And they, you know, they kill them, they, you know, they sacrifice themselves at the end. And that kind of is meant to leave us with like this positive taste in our mouths, you know, as a final taste of that character, and kind of justify them passing on to this kind of, you know, positive afterlife or whatever. And, but you never see that, you never see that equation reversed. Like, what if somebody, how would we feel if there was this character who was just a freaking saint their whole lives, and then they knew they were going to die in about a week, and they'd, you know, they'd like saved countless lives throughout their life. They'd just been so self-sacrificing and all this kind of stuff, you know, and all these lives are saved because of them. All these lives are made better because of them. And then in their last week, they just decide, I am just going to kill people. I'm going to kill children and old people and, you know, newlyweds, and I'm just going to, you know, crush people's lives and destroy them, you know, for 1 week, because I have saved so many people that surely, you know, I'm due this. You know, I've saved a million lives. What's 60? You know, we would not be comfortable with that. We'd be like, oh my gosh, that's terrible. And we wouldn't be comfortable with the idea of them going off into this nice, you know, wonderful afterlife without any consequences for what they've done, you know. So anyway, the whole philosophy of balance and morality and making yourself worthy, you know, of some great, you know, afterlife and stuff, it just totally unravels as soon as you bring in just human nature into the mix, you know. I mean, the fact is, from a biblical standpoint, that what we owe God is complete and perfect obedience. You know, we owe him complete and perfect obedience. And so the idea of like being, you know, super obedient to make up for previous flaws, you know, it's like, well, you should have been super obedient anyway. So you're not really making up for anything. You can't. That's why we can't do that, because we owe him perfect obedience. So we don't have the time in this life to make up for, anyway. So yeah, it was, you know, a decent episode. I forgot that this was a two-parter, not a three-parter. I thought that this was a three-parter and she died in the three-parter, but yeah. Oh yeah. So the behind the scenes stuff, I'm going kind of long here, but the reason, if you've watched the behind the scene features on the DVD or Blu-ray sets of this, then you know the story. But if you don't, Virginia Hay, who plays Zan, discovered, I don't know, sometime maybe during season two, that just this the makeup was just really causing some health problems for her, because she was shaving her head and they put this thick makeup all over her, you know, her head, you know, and I guess your scalp is a place where you sweat and kind of release toxins and things from your body. And they just didn't, you know, account for, you know, what that prolonged kind of exposure is sealing off of her body, in a sense, would be doing to her. At one point, I guess a doctor said, have you been spending a lot of time around like a paint factory or something after doing like some blood tests or something like that? So she was like, no, but I do have this makeup. And it's like, oh man, you know, and her health, I think, I don't know if she was just more susceptible to sickness during her time on the show, but anyway, it was just causing this degeneration in her health. And what's interesting to me is that they didn't start doing a bald cap for her, you know? I have to watch the special features again, because I remember, you know, they wanted from the very outset, they wanted an actress who was willing to shave her head, because a bald cap just looks different than, you know, when someone shaves their head. Especially for a woman, because they often have just a little extra hair, and so that bald cap makes their head just a little bit more bulbous, you know. And they definitely didn't want to do that on the show. But I don't think they offered her that option. I can't remember now. It makes me want to go back and watch those interviews and stuff where they kind of tell that whole story. But, you know, maybe, I mean, did the producer just feel like, well, you know, if she's not going to wear the bald cap, or if she's, you know, not going to be able to stick around and keep shaving her head and do the makeup this way, then, you know, we'll just have to say goodbye to her character, you know. It makes me want, yeah, it's pure wild speculation if they just felt like maybe her character wasn't working out as much, and so this was just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back in their heart of hearts. Of course, they would never tell her this, but I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm probably the only one that dislikes Zan. I mean, she definitely has her sweet moments. She just rubs me the wrong way, reminds me of people that are just fakey.
in their, you know, kind of superficial, super spirituality. Anyway, that's it. Blah, 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 blah. Next time, it's Different Destinations, which I cannot for the life of me remember what it's about, but I'm sure it's going to be better because it won't have Xan in it. Oh, no, 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 that's not true, because now we got freaking Jewel. And Jewel and Stark sharing a scene together, and they're the only ones in the scene? Oh, my gosh, that's too much for me. That's too much. Don't ever do that again. Don't ever just put those two in a scene talking to each other, because they are both freaking drama queens, and they just, not, you know, not that what they're experiencing isn't, like, totally worth freaking out about, but maybe it's just something about their performances. I'm just like, oh, my gosh. Okay, so we've eliminated Xan, but now we have Jewel, and we still have Stark. anyway, all right. Bye.